Hi everyone, and welcome to season 2 of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you're new here, my name is Eugenia Chow, and I run the Instagram account Eugenia. The Everyday Activist podcast is founded under the belief that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to activism, and anyone can get involved. For this week's episode, we have Teresa Rose Sebastian. She is a 17-year-old climate and social justice activist, originally from India but currently based in Cork. She works in the field of education, empowerment, and reform in Ireland, India, and internationally. She also co-founded the international organization ReEarth Initiative and now works to spread education and empower young people, women in particular, to stand and work together for justice. In this episode, we discuss three pillars of environmental activism: youth empowerment, tips for networking in the environmental space, using social media as a tool for activism, and balancing advocacy work as a full-time student. Every time I speak to Teresa, I feel so inspired by all the work that she's done for the climate movement. I also feel so empowered and motivated after engaging with her work to do more myself. Despite being only 17 years old, Teresa has so much wisdom to share about different views on the climate movement and also different social justice issues in general. I really hope you enjoy this episode, and I'm sure you'll find something valuable from what she has to say. Hi, Tessie, and welcome to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. I'm so glad that we've connected, and I'm so excited to learn more about the different initiatives you're involved with and also just your general experience as a climate activist. So firstly, could you please introduce yourself? Who are you and how would you describe the work that you do?
Perfect. So who am I? Well, that's a question I think I'm still pondering on, but to be short and brief, my name is Teresa Rose Sebastian, but everyone kind of calls me Tess. I'm a 17-year-old climate and social justice activist. I'm originally from South India, but I emigrated to Ireland about 15 years ago. So I've been here ever since. And the work that I do is mostly based around climate and social justice, and then circles around three main ideas of empowerment, education, and reform. So that's me in like a nutshell.
So how would you describe your environmental narrative? How did you get involved with this activism? When did this journey start, and what sort of kickstarted it?
Right. So I think for me growing up, I've always had like an inherent love for nature, because both of my parents grew up in not the best financial situations. They both grew up in poverty. My father only got an education because he was fortunate enough to receive a scholarship. My mother, on the other hand, her father became paralyzed at a very young age, and she kind of had to take the lead with educating her family and stuff. So for them, what gave them sustenance was the land that they had, the very little land that they had. So for them, you know, nature was always something that was more than just what they saw outside. It was what sustained them. It was what gave them nutrition. So when my parents shifted over here, we made sure that the house we had a garden. My parents started gardening, honestly, as soon as we shifted into Ireland. And we were very fortunate because Ireland is a very green country. So my parents knew that this was the right choice for us, because my home in India is also very green. It's a state called Kerala, and it's also nicknamed God's own country because of how nature filled it is, basically. So from a very young age, I've always had that inherent love for nature, and I've always been a bit of a rebel. I think growing up, I was given a lot of liberties or privileges that other people my same age or even older weren't receiving, because my parents were a bit more liberal. And I've always kind of grown up seeing, you know, that's not really fair. So I've always had a bit of a rebel in me. But I was never able to put the two things together. I was never felt secure or empowered enough to take action, because I thought, you know, that's just me. I'll just be an angsty little teenager and that'll be it. But what really changed a lot for me was actually facing the climate crisis like head on. And that happened in 2018. I had gone home to India for like a month or so, because we only get to go home every 2 years because it's fairly expensive to fly home. And when we had gone home, you know, there was these like monsoon rains, which we expect nearly every year at the same time. But what we had received during that period was extreme. You know, it wasn't anything that we had expected. It was torrential floods. And basically what happened was that the entire state of Kerala basically flooded. And I mean floods as in houses were submerged and all of that. So it was a bit extreme. And I lived in an apartment at that time, so we weren't allowed to go out during the night because the water had risen so far. My entire car park was actually submerged. And I remember there was a night where we heard a siren go off. And my initial thought was, this is it. Like, this is the end. I'm going to have to move. I'm going to have to be shifted off by the army to a secure place because my apartment is no longer inhabitable. But what had actually happened was when the car park had completely submerged, somebody had forgotten to take their car out, and that car had actually risen to the top. And that opened a lot for me because I was like, this is not normal. Like, I've heard about the monsoon rains. I've played in the monsoon rains as a kid, but what we had received that year was not normal. And then I was able to come home here to Ireland, and I realized, you know, nobody was speaking about it. Like, I told my friends and they were like, this happened? What? And I was like, yeah, 400 people died. You didn't hear about it. And they said no. And I think for me, that level of media ignorance and the fact that, you know, I lost 400 people in my own country, in my own state, and the nature that was destroyed, that really hit me. And then I realized this is something that I can't keep quiet on. It's a privilege I have that allowed me to come home here to Ireland to a safe, clean home that I'd have to spend the next month cleaning out, like a lot of families in India. Mm-hmm. And I started researching and educating myself, and I realized I'm able to have a voice in a country that protects my voice. I'm not, you know, in danger for raising my voice here in Ireland. So that was kind of the catalyst that made me realize I can do something. And I think over the years, as I started getting into more environmental ventures and initiatives, I became more and more empowered until I reached today, where I'm now like, I know that if I have a campaign idea or an initiative idea, I have the skills and resources to implement it. So there, that was kind of the catalyst that pushed me here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's super inspiring. I think not a lot of people have that sort of like firsthand experience and have that impact on their environmental narrative and wanting to take action because of that. So definitely interesting to hear your point of view. So you talked about how you divide your work into three sectors. Could you expand on that and talk a bit more about how you view your role in the environmental and social justice movement and how you act upon these passions that you have?
So I think my three areas of work kind of come in from where I felt I lacked initially when I started entering the movement. I definitely, for me, it was education and empowerment. You know, I knew very little. I was taught very little. So that for me is a very important part, which is why I think I push for access to education a lot. Education is not just a tool or something we have in the back of the head. It's what literally forms and molds our mindset every day. It forms the foundation of how we live our life, why we live our life, and what we live for. So I started using education as a tool to change people's mindset or even encourage them to think beyond the surface of the climate crisis, because a lot of people think, you know, yes, the planet is heating up, but that's for the next 50, 100 years, because that's all we're taught. We're taught global warming is when carbon emissions and the atmosphere, but we're never taught further than that. So for me, what I do is I try to educate people, not just about the climate crisis, but about topics that are not spoken as much. And as of now, I'm currently working on creating an education curriculum program for rural schools specifically. And the reason I chose rural schools specifically is because schools who have access to this sort of information or have a bigger presence when it comes to decision making have the responsibility themselves to provide this information. But rural schools and voluntary schools don't have that resource. And therefore, it's my responsibility or active organizers' responsibility to actively outreach and provide those resources. So that's one of the things I'm working on. So that's education entirely. And I think a really lovely quote that I use a lot whenever I talk about education is, you know, it's not just the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire. Because that's what it was from my experience. It educated me, it ignited my passion and my love to fight for climate justice. So that's education. And then empowerment, because I think it's important that we're not just given the tools, we're taught how to use them. Because someone can sit with the information they have in their heads for years. You know, we talk about learning the Pythagoras theorem. I can have that information in my head and then move on and work as a lawyer for the next 20 odd years without ever thinking about it. And that at the moment is what we're doing with kids and education. We're giving them these tools, but they're just holding them. are never given an opportunity to put them to use or make something out of it. And I think that's where empowerment comes in. So I work on creating like empowerment activities. I'm doing this website here in Ireland because the youth climate movement or the youth activist movement here in Ireland is not as strong as it is in other places. And that's basically because it's not spoken about. You know, if you were to say youth climate activists, you'd be able to name out the 5 or 6 people in Ireland who are, you know, working in that, which I think isn't fair because, you know, Ireland as a country who fought for our independence has a lot of history when it comes to rebellion and activism, but we were never taught to continue that on. It was kind of wiped out after a while. So I'm working on creating a website for young people to look and learn from other young people who have been given these empowerment skills. And I'm working on creating that for the following topics of like community organizing, education, speaking to people. So that's the entire aspect of empowerment. And then finally reform, because it's all good and well to empower and educate within the broken system, but we need to make sure that we change the system. And that's why I try to work in reform, policy reform. The way communities work too is something I'm trying to delve into a bit further, because we've for so long we've had the power within our hands, but we've just never been given the tools to use it. I think that's where reform comes in. We need to change this entire attitude of, you know, the governments are the only ones who can make change. It's not. That's reforming a social aspect as well. So yeah, I think that's the three of them.
Mm-hmm. I love that so much. I love how intentional you are with how you divide your work. And like, it's, yeah, like your passion for these issues really shows through like the way that you're conveying your message and everything. And I'm just like very impressed by how well thought out this is as well. Definitely very inspired by how much you've been able to do for this movement. So the way we connected was through Bring Back Green, because you were involved with that and like recruiting speakers. Could you talk a bit about that involvement, what you did with Bring Back Green, which department of your activism that aligns the most with, and I guess anything you want to share about it?
Mm-hmm. So Bring Back Green is an organization in Kerala, which is the state I'm from, and it's run by Akhilesh Anil Kumar. And basically what they do is climate education and climate empowerment, which really fits into my two values of education and empowerment. And the conference I met you at, Eugenia, was the International Climate Education Conference. So why we did this was because we are currently in the midst of creating a climate education app for students across Kerala. The reason we chose Kerala initially was because we had the support of the education minister there, and we knew that this would be direct action. You know, we wouldn't have to campaign for it for a longer term. So we decided to first work in Kerala. We're hoping to now spread this later on, but we had 3 consultations: the international conference, which Eugenia spoke at, we held a national one for individuals across India, and then we held a state level one, which is from across Kerala. And we are basically compiling all of that information and listening to the people of what exactly should be involved in this climate education curriculum. And we are very proud to say that we are setting up our app. Our app is basically done. We are creating like the curriculum now. And then on the empowerment aspect, what we're doing is we're holding capacity training programs for a lot of the master's students who are learning to be teachers. And I actually moderated one of those. And the basic foundation of it is we teach them this. We basically give them like a little perspective of what did we find from our international conference? And these are the topics that should be taught. We then discuss with the master students, and we're like, what are good ways for you as teachers or future teachers to teach this to young students? And then we have this little project at the end where these teachers come up with a little curriculum themselves, depending on the topics. And that's been going on really well. We've already done one entire college. We're moving on to another one. And hopefully we're working on creating the app to be launched sometime this year, at the end of the year, while also preparing a team of master's students who will work with us as to spread climate education. So it's really working on climate education and empowerment.
That's super cool. I love how you, as a 17-year-old, are in the position where you're educating like master's students and just students of all ages. Like, that's super cool. So I imagine with all these projects you're working on, you have to be able to connect with a lot of people. And as you mentioned, people of different ages.
Mm-hmm.
For anyone who wants to be more involved with these types of initiatives and wants to sort of network with people within the environmental movement, what advice would you give them and how do you usually approach this?
I think reach out. Sometimes it's really scary to reach out to a stranger sometimes, but I think for me, that's been one of the biggest key points, is being willing to ask for help or ask for connections. And I've always put that out to whoever's on my socials. It's like, if you're looking to get involved with the movement, reach out. You know, even if it's as simple as I'm really good at designing or I'm really good at organizing, everyone's skills are needed in the movement. Actively, I think try LinkedIn. LinkedIn is actually a really good place to connect, not just like a business level, but other individuals who have the very same interests as you. I met a lot of people, and actually some of the speakers we got for the educational conference was through LinkedIn. And I've also met a lot of young people who reached out to me through LinkedIn and asked, you know, I'm interested in setting up this in my local area, or, you know, is there any initiatives I can log on to? It's just reaching out. It's taking that big first step, because afterwards, everything else will fall in place, or you'll find your own niche spots as well. And I think we'll talk later about this, but that's actually how I got into co-founding an organization, was merely because I reached out, became part of this little WhatsApp group where people would send in opportunities. And now I co-founded an organization. So it's just reaching out.
Is this organization you're talking about, ReEarth Initiative?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect segue, because I was going to ask about this anyway. But so I guess if you could start by talking about this little WhatsApp group, how that was formed and how this led to the formation of ReEarth Initiative, that would be really great.
Perfect. So basically it was this group on WhatsApp called Global Activists that I think someone had set up and kind of put out the link to, and I knew someone who was admitting it. So I was like, oh, look, I'm really interested in meeting more people in the movement, because I was at that time I was working in Ireland and I hadn't met a lot of Indian activists. So I wanted to reach out more. So I joined this WhatsApp group. It wasn't really active, but one night I remember I was cooking dinner and I got a WhatsApp message from the group, and this girl called Sophia had asked, saying, is there anyone here who would be interested in working on like social media for a campaign? So I was like, okay, I can do that, because I'm a big nerd for like marketing and social media. So I reached out and I was like, hi, you don't really know me, but I'm interested in helping out if needed. And we got on a call, and that's kind of set off the journey. I campaigned with them, and then I got to know the team really well. And I guess that's where ReEarth came.
So what does ReEarth Initiative aim to do? Like, what's the gap that it aims to fill? Because I am aware that it is an international movement that is formed mostly by youth activists.
Perfect. So ReEarth Initiative firstly started off as a campaign. We wanted to do something for Earth Day because it was the 50th anniversary and a lot of us were in lockdown, but we didn't want to stop the conversation or forget about this, you know, monumental day. So a group of us came together and we decided we wanted to create a campaign that united people. So we decided to do pledges, you know, pledges for Mother Earth. And it was a really successful campaign. We impacted over 300,000 people, 1,000 plus people actually participated in the campaign through their pledges, and over 15,000 people had actually watched our Instagram lives. So it was a really successful campaign. But one of the things we had noticed was we were able to break the climate, the climate chamber, basically, because a lot of the team members and volunteers who had joined us at that time had never been able to delve into an environmental initiative before. Maybe that was because of gatekeeping, or maybe because none of the initiatives allowed for that accessibility. And for us, when we realized that, we were like, okay, then we can't stop the work we're doing. The work we're doing is powerful, it's impactful, and it's bringing more young people into the movement. So we had to sit down and we were like, how do we continue the work that we do while also making sure that whatever voice or whatever mic we have in the movement, it is respective to the work we do. So as of now, we are officially a youth-led NGO. Our main aim is climate justice while also making the climate movement an inclusive and unified space which can be accessible for all. Because I'm sure you know yourself, Eugenia, we do have an issue with the climate chamber and a bit of gatekeeping. So that was, you know, quite important to the work we do. And basically what we do is we do educational toolkits, which we try to spread to schools. And one thing that I'm very proud of that we do here in ReEarth Initiative is we actively outreach. Because sometimes, you know, putting out that information there and within that climate chamber just means it's going to stick there. once you actively outreach and make sure you take the steps, even though it might be a bit more time consuming or a bit more energy consuming, breaking that chamber, it's important to do that, which is why for us here at ReEarth Initiative, it's very important to be actively outreach. So we also do educational toolkits, which we post on our website and our social media. And then we also have an internal team. We're currently at around 180, and we work on empowering them within our organization as well through like workshops and all of that. But as an organization, climate justice, social justice, and accessibility are the main values we have.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So I always wonder whether it should be more of a priority to focus on people who already care about the environment and like are within that echo chamber of environmental activism and wanting to advance these different issues, whether it's a priority to target them, empower them, and like mobilize them to become agents of change as well? Or is it more important to focus on people who don't already care about the environmental movement and to get them to care? I know that both of them, like obviously both of them play an important role in the movement, but I guess I wonder if you have a priority or if ReEarth Initiative has a priority when it comes to who they're targeting.
On behalf of ReEarth Initiative, I think we try to make our content as accessible as we can. So we do, everyone who follows us is part of the eco chamber. So we do make sure that they receive that information. We take it a step further and we make sure that those who don't know also receive this information. Because, you know, it's those who are empowered who can empower others. So by taking on the individuals who are interested and who are wanting to do more, we are then indirectly empowering others because we are a very international and diverse group of people, which I love and appreciate. I slowly shed a tear every time I go on one of our meetings because it's just people from all corners of the world. And it's honestly amazing. Like, I'm such a mom, but I will cry whenever I see that. And it's great because, you know, we have, I think, two pairs of sisters who have joined us. So we've got two people from Lebanon and two people from Indonesia. And that happened because one sister joined us initially who told their sister, you know, this is happening. This is really cool. So I think for us, it's making sure the empowered empower others while also trying to empower those who are unsure ourselves. And then on a personal level, my Instagram account is, I don't have a separate one for activism. I kind of have my personal and activism one together. And through that, I try to break the chamber and bring information that like maybe friends of mine who wouldn't follow my activism account or people who follow me now who wouldn't normally follow my activism account if I had one, are being educated constantly in whatever I post on my story, whether that's, you know, about sex education, women's rights, or climate rights. It's climate justice, sorry. So I think what my values and the values ReEarth Initiative has are very similar, but we do try to both encourage those who are in the chamber to take action while encouraging those outside of the chamber to find their space in the movement.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that you brought that up about social media as a way to break that echo chamber, because me personally, I actually deactivated my personal Instagram a while ago. And so the only one that I use is this sort of like activism one. And I always think about, I go through moments where I'm like, oh, I feel bad that everyone I meet sort of only has one option of like which account to follow. But then I think about it and it's actually a great thing because it means that they're sort of not forced, but their only option of like interacting with me in a social media space mm-hmm. to engage with stuff that like relates to the climate movement. And in a way they have to learn about it, whether they like it or not. And so social media is definitely a really great way to reach people who maybe otherwise wouldn't be as interested in these causes or these issues. Sure.
And it's an amazing way to network as well. I mean, look at the two of us on this podcast itself. Like, you are on the opposite side of the world and I'm all the way here. But because of social media, we've been able to connect. And I think also the spreading of information has become a lot faster as well. So it's a great tool when used correctly, of course. But yeah, it is a great tool.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know, are you a part of the Asian Environmental Youth Network?
I am, likely.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we might have like connected there before, but that's also another thing that I want to mention for anyone listening who might be interested in like networking with people in the environmental space. This one's targeted more towards Asian activists, and there's just like a huge growing network of young people, and it's really it's a great way to connect with others as well.
It is. And they have like amazing networking events where you get to meet people. And unfortunately, I haven't had an opportunity to attend one because they're always at like 3 a.m. my time. But they always post a picture into the chat and it looks amazing. So definitely, if anyone's listening and interested, do check it out. The Instagram account is AEYN.org, the Asian Environmental Youth Network org. So do check it out.
Yes. And they also have a website, and I think you can just contact them to join. And then you'll be added to Slack group, and they have occasional meetings and discussion going on, which is really great. Also, speaking of social media, since your online presence as an activist started with your personal account, I guess it's a different trajectory, and it might have been scary for you to begin sharing these kind of things and shifting your account towards this direction. I imagine many people have that idea or like want to do that with their social media, but might be afraid to. So do you have any advice for anyone who wants to dabble in some social media activism using their personal accounts?
I think protect yourself first, because I am quite vocal on a lot of things. For example, like climate justice is fine because it's not as controversial as some of the other things I advocate for when it comes to like women's rights or comprehensive sex ed. So for me, what I did initially was I really had to sit down and I was like, how important are these topics to me? And how important is it for me to spread those? Because for a lot of people, you know, you need to find your spot in the movement. You might be a writer, you might be someone who works behind the scenes, and you might be someone who talks a lot. For me, I'm a mix of the talking and working behind the scenes. I knew that for me, one of the ways I can become I can advocate is through my social media. So the first thing I kind of did was I went through my current followers and I was kind of like, who here am I comfortable enough to put out my content to? Because you are in charge of your social media. You are not, if people don't want to watch your content, they are free to leave. Again, that's if you are posting correct, factual, and safe information, which I think is, again, a very important point. Always double check your information, because social media, as great as it is, can be misused, as like all great things. So do fact check. But if you know you are in the right, you don't owe your time to anyone on social media. There's a lot of trolls and a lot of people who are on there for the sole reason of spreading hate, and you don't owe your time to them. So for me, what I did was I knew that I wanted to speak about sex education and I wanted to speak about sexual empowerment, but I knew that I had certain people on my socials who could misuse what I'm saying. So the first thing I did was I created a block list of certain people that I was like, I don't appreciate you watching my content because you're either a family friend who has very different opinions and who wouldn't be open to a discussion. So if you're looking to start it, firstly, you know, really figure out what do you want to do, because it's important to have that, because when you're posting controversial stuff, you will get that bit of, you know, playing the devil's advocate, someone questioning you. But when you are true to your values and true to what you know, it gives you that confidence to kind of be like, I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing is right. And I know this is my activism. So definitely, you know, finding out what you want to post about. Secondly, protecting yourself, whether that's one thing that I have is my socials don't have my actual full name. And that's to kind of protect myself from relatives who wouldn't be the biggest fan of the work that I do. So that's why Tess is how people know me. My real name isn't on social media. That was just a decision I had to take. Mm-hmm. And then finally, fact check everything. Make sure the information you put out there is right, because as much as you can delete something afterwards, the information stays. The people you've impacted continue to be impacted. You know, you might post something that might be wrong. You might apologize for it, but you can never take it out of someone's mind afterwards. So yeah, those would be my kind of three things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, those are all very valuable pieces of advice. So you talked a bit about how you hope to use your social media to talk about sexual empowerment and related topics. As I can tell, you're a really strong advocate for gender equality and sexual empowerment. So is there any particular reason why you hope to raise awareness about these issues? Obviously, they're all very important, but do they align with your other forms of advocacy in any outstanding way?
I think women's empowerment is very close to home, because as a South Asian woman and as an Indian woman, I have seen the way women are treated in India and in South Asia, where we are still struggling to be treated the same as our male peers. And for me growing up, because I was living here, I was given these different sort of liberties and privileges that I were thought this is a normal thing, you know, my guy friends are having these privileges, so why can't I? So for me, that was the angle I took. And it wasn't until I got a lot older where I was seeing my fellow female peers, sorry, my fellow women peers who weren't been given those same privileges, and their brothers or their younger brothers were. And I realized, you know, even though we weren't living in India, that sort of mindset was still present here in Ireland, where the society, the Irish society, are a lot different when it comes to mindset. So I have always grown up with this potential sort of, not like a jail cell, but like a potential sort of wall waiting for me the day that maybe my parents are like, no, you can't do this because that's not what girls do. Or I was seeing that wall being put in front of my women friends who had such amazing potential, but because that wall was put there, because that's not what girls do, they were never allowed to achieve that. So I knew that I couldn't, you know, again, it came back to me knowing that I can't stay quiet on that. I had to voice it. So I tried to do that a lot. I was always the girl in like classes who would, when the teacher calls out for boys to come and pick up the chairs, I'd be like, no, I'm going to pick up. And I would have like 10 chairs on both hands, and I'd be panting, and I'd be, but I would do it. You know, I would make sure that that teacher knew what mm-hmm. she said wasn't fair. You know, I would tell it. And I've had a good few parents come up to my parents and was like, oh, your daughter's she's a little loud. You know, she told me to tell her to pick up the chairs. And my dad was kind of like, yeah, why didn't you tell her, you know, to pick up the chairs? I'm very lucky to have parents who get me to a certain degree. Like, my parents know that there's certain things that I will not stand. And they've made it clear to other parents who would come up to them and be like, oh, you know, Teresa didn't really, she didn't, we have this thing in church where in India, women have to sit on one side and men have to sit on another, and women have to wear a shawl. I've never stuck to that because I was like, it's hot. It's really hot in India. And going to mass, going to church, the full church, and it's like, it's comfortable. And sometimes you'll see that the men's section have like 3 people sitting in a space for 150 people. And the women's section has people sitting on the floor because there's no chairs. And it's like, well, there's a lot of chairs over there. Why can't we just sit? So I've always been like that rebel. But for me, it came to the point where I was able to fight for those privileges within my own family structure. And then I was like, I have to fight for others now. I have to make sure that people talk about it. So that's where women empowerment comes for me. Sexual empowerment and sexual education comes from the point that it's so unknown, and that's why it's so tabooed. Like, I say sex, and I'm like, I would talk about sex education to my parents, and initially they were like, no, we don't talk about that. And then I continuously started saying it, and they were like, okay, we'll talk about it. But it's been used as a way to limit women for so long. You know, we were our only value was sexual reproduction, and yet even then, we weren't allowed to use it for our own pleasure. It was one thing, pregnancy, that was it. And it was used to restrict us so much. And we've developed so much further on, and yet we're still not given that sort of freedom from this restriction of sexual reproduction is our only goal. That's why I work a lot in like talking about women pleasure, or for those who have vaginas, we talk about vagina pleasure and stuff like that, because a lot of the times, like, you will still meet someone, and people have this connotation that sex is supposed to hurt the first time. It's never supposed to hurt. And the only reason it does is because the person with the vagina isn't lubricated enough, because they are never given that sort of pleasure first. And therefore, that's why it hurts. And that's why it bleeds. But you're not supposed to have that. But that's never taught to us. So that came as a part of women empowerment, which was that giving people that sexual liberation by educating them about the reality of sexual intercourse and sexual ed, which is not just comprehensive sex ed. It's not just sexual intercourse. It's talking about knowing what does your body like and not like, knowing consent, knowing sexual health, and just knowing what is good for me, what do I like, and allowing yourself to decide for yourself what do you like. Because again, coming up in like a South Asian community, people are told, oh, you're supposed to hurt, or you're supposed to bleed, and you're given the strict and narrow path of what you're supposed to like. But a lot of people don't. Like, this is something I talk a lot about, is orgasms. It's like a lot of women don't actually orgasm from sexual penetration, which is okay. We all have different things, but we're told, oh, you must, or men are told, that's how you pleasure a woman. And it's like, no. So it really came into this whole idea of liberating women from societal structures.
Wow. Yeah. I really admire how vocal you are about these things, and how at like even such a young age with your family, you're able to like educate them and also have these.
It was a struggle. I mean, they hear me say the word sex, and I've had to continuously repeat it until it came to the point where it was no longer a taboo word, but it was definitely a struggle.
Yeah, I mean, just even having that awareness that it's something that needs to be talked about is just really cool, and a lot of respect for that. So I guess talking about gender equality as well, it's very clear that there's a disproportionate representation of women in the environmental movement, especially in more like official roles in government and stuff like that. I'm assuming this is something you've thought about. So why do you think that women are perhaps less represented? And what do you think people can do to ensure that all genders are equally empowered and also have a voice in this movement?
If you look at the people on the forefront, people on the grounds who are fighting and protesting, women and women of color make up a huge percentage of those fighting at the forefront. But if you look at those in power, those who are given the opportunity to make changes, it's very white, cis, male dominated, or very male dominated. And I think that's because women have the experience, the truth, and the reality of what is happening today. We know that whatever the climate crisis, or when we talk about bills about, you know, sexual reproduction rights or other stuff like that, we have the experience that fuels a passion inside of us to fight for that right today, not tomorrow, not for the next 10 years. You know, a lot of the times we have bills that realistically should be passed today, but they're pushed aside for later because those who are in power have probably never experienced that. They've never experienced the reason that this bill was put forward. And I think that's one of the reasons why, personally, when I looked at that question, I really had to ponder a lot. I think that came for me first, because, you know, you look at COP26 and there's a campaign going on today, like in the 21st century, for what most people would call a developed country. And for those listening, I said developed with the two commas, because I think that needs to be said.
Yeah.
You know, we're fighting for women to get representation on the organizing panel itself. And it's like, that should be there. That should have been there years ago. That shouldn't be what we're fighting for today, but it is. And I think it's because we bring the reality and experience that is stopping governments at the moment and people in power from taking action. We bring that, and they're scared of it, which is why we're one of the biggest groups of people who are fighting and organizing for climate justice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely, for sure. And I guess by that same vein, what do you think is something that is lacking from the mainstream environmental movement and also mainstream environmental discourse? Is there anything people should direct their attention more towards that you think is lacking?
I think it's the acceptance that it's happening today, because I still meet a lot of people who are like, oh, you know, our lives will be destroyed in the next 20 years. And it's like, lives were destroyed yesterday. Lives were destroyed 10 years ago. Lives are being destroyed today. And I think that sort of acceptance will allow us to genuinely take the action that's needed, because people in governments, individual people, organizations are still fighting. Well, some of them are still fighting for climate justice as if it is a problem of tomorrow. And once we change this perspective and we change the way we look on it, and we change it to realizing that this is today, we're fighting for today, we're fighting for the lives of the people tomorrow, it changes everything. It really changes the way you do stuff. I think that's one of the biggest things we're missing now, because once you have that sort of acceptance that this is happening today, you will take the radical action needed. And when I mean radical, I mean the necessary action, because sometimes people think the necessary action is radical. For example, pre-COVID, we were talking about stopping business as usual and shutting down the fossil fuel industry. People called us radical. During COVID, we see business stopping. We see fossil fuel companies taking losses. And that was considered okay. And I think it's once you realize that today is the issue, that we're fighting for today is for today, people change their mindsets and we can get the necessary action needed. A second thing that I think we're missing is passing the mic. I know it's hard to pass the mic at times because you have so much you want to say. As someone, I mean, I've experienced it once and I have a lot to say. It's impacted me a lot, but even I myself have to remember there are people who are still in India, who are still facing this, people all across the world, indigenous communities who have been facing this for years. You know, I do have a story. I have an environment narrative, but I also have to remember there are times where I have to step down. There are times where I have to pass the mic on. I think those personally, the two things are missing the most is acceptance of reality, that this is the problem of today, and learning to pass the mic. I think that's things I need to work on myself, because some of the projects I take on, I have to realize, okay, this is fighting for something that they think is happening in the next 20 years. And I have to realize that's not part of my morals or my values. I'm fighting for projects and I'm fighting for a change that will impact us today or tomorrow. So yeah, those would be the two things I think are missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you saying pass the mic reminds me of an initiative that Tori To founded, who I interviewed actually in one of the earlier episodes of this podcast. Yeah. So there's an account on Instagram. I'll also put in the show notes, called Pass the Mic Climate. And it's a really incredible initiative that does exactly that. And I think it started as a campaign to get David Attenborough to pass the mic because he had such a huge platform and wasn't doing anything about it. And so it's a way to reach different people and also give a voice to activists on the front lines who usually aren't given that same platform.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that in the climate movement itself. Like, people sometimes forget that the climate movement and climate justice aren't terms that have just popped up in the last 2 years. They've been there for, I mean, we've celebrated 50 years of Earth Day, and Earth Day was created to protect the environment. Indigenous communities have been shouting for ages. It's just that the mic was never passed. It was never even created initially. And now that we have created that mic, it's important that we pass it back to those who have been fighting this for years. Like, there is this amazing activist called Kevin Patel, who is also a US activist. It's his decade anniversary of fighting for climate justice. So, you know, it's remembering that this is a movement that has been speaking and shouting for years, but that mic was never created for them. And now it is, and we have to utilize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So moving forward, what can people expect from the sort of work that you're going to be doing in this space? I guess you're like working on many projects at once, but is there anything in particular that's coming up that you would want to share and people can look forward to?
On the terms of education, the curriculum that I created with a few of my fellow team members from the Philippines have officially been used by the schools in Uganda. So we were successful in bringing that to the schools. The private schools will be incorporating it as part of their curriculum. I'm now hoping to spread that to more schools. So I'm going to try reach out to a few accounts on social media, a few schools, websites, and provide this information. So on the terms of education, that's that. I'm also trying to delve in a bit more into women's empowerment. So I am working with this lovely girl who is creating an organization for South Sudan, who's working on child marriages and trying to break that sort of structure. So a lot of that's coming ahead is reform and empowerment, and I'm very excited to keep going. My head comes up with many ideas continuously, and it's developing those that I'm trying to work on.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Super exciting. And so a question that I ask everyone who comes onto the show is, what does being an activist mean to you?
It means fighting for justice. And I think that's something that has become central to the work I do, which has allowed me to fight, to become an intersectional activist. It's really, for me, being an activist is actively fighting for justice. It's taking the time out of my day taking time out of my day to actively work on this. It's taking time to work on different projects, but making sure that the reason I'm doing it is to ensure justice prevails. And I think that's core to my work. It's justice.
Mm-hmm. As a full-time student, how do you balance your activism with schoolwork and making sure that you're, I guess, prioritizing both and doing both to the degree that's like you're satisfied with and also being able to put your best effort towards?
Yeah, it's been hard because I started doing a lot of my personal projects in the last year. And in the last year, I was in an academic year that didn't require a lot out of me from as a student. It was like a, it's this thing we have in Ireland called transition year, which basically is like you do activities to kind of better your personal development. So I had the time available. I'm now in fifth year, which is preparing for my university exam at the end of next year. So it has definitely been hard, but I have this thing where I kind of struggle with like FOMO, feeling of missing out, which is why I'm tied in with a lot of projects. I think it was kind of really sitting down and reflecting on my priorities, taking the projects I can actually take on while incorporating school. Because I think the one mistake I made was I never put school as like a responsibility or like a task I had to do. It was always at the end of my mind. And by incorporating that as part of my schedule, you know, making sure that if I do take on a new project or if a current project is requiring more responsibility of me, I time in school. But it is hard. But I think personally for me, that's part of being an activist. It's making that time available while being respectful to your own mental health as well as your other responsibilities. But yeah, it's making that time and then allowing yourself to say no to different projects, as exciting as it could be. Mm-hmm. Prioritizing your mental health first.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so I guess since you're still in, you said your fifth year, I guess where do you see yourself in maybe 5 years or 10 years down the line? You can envision that both in terms of like academic, where you'll be, and sort of also just the trajectory of your activism and how you want to continue being involved.
5 years, I would have hopefully finished my degree in, I'm between law and social justice and law and politics, because one thing I'm sure I want to do is I want to work for the people. That's been central to my work right now as a student activist, and I want that to be central to my work in the future as well. So I'm hoping to go into law and politics and then either work in an NGO or work on the ground. I want to do on the ground projects. But I'm hoping that 5 years, 10 years, 15 or 20 years, I'll still be working for the people and working for justice. So as long as those two things are part of my life plan, I'm happy to go ahead with whatever life wants to throw at me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, love that. Also, yeah, lots of room for unexpected turns and just like anything can happen.
Yeah, that's the fun of life. You never know what could throw at you next. I've had some bricks, I've had some microwaves, but I've also had hugs and amazing people thrown at me too. So it's as long as I have those two factors, I'm happy to take it as it comes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just knowing everything that you're doing as well, I know that you'll find many ways to continue this.
You know, I hope so.
Everything. So finally, I guess, what are some resources you would recommend to anyone hoping to learn more about these topics that we've discussed today? So this can be articles or books or videos, documentaries, or even podcasts, Instagram accounts, literally anything that you have to share.
Oh, there's so much. But if you're looking for education about the climate and just the environment in general, I like 100% recommend this website called Climate Science. They give you all of the scientific information in a way that's easy to understand, because I am not a science major. Me and science have a very iffy relationship, so I don't really understand it. But I have been able to understand and learn more through their resources, so I 100% recommend Climate Science. If you're looking for a more intersectional and social justice-based perspective, there's a lot of amazing Instagram accounts you can follow, like Tori. Who else? There's a lot of Indigenous activists. If you look at the ReEarth Initiative Instagram account, which is at re.earth.org, we have guides for like Indigenous women you should follow, climate activists you should follow, trans activists you should follow. And those people are definitely people I would 100% recommend. So check out the ReEarth Initiative Instagram, and you'll find a lot of resources there too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. This was, oh my God, such a great conversation. I definitely feel educated and very much empowered. I think talking to you just makes me feel so motivated to continue doing more as well. It's honestly so admirable, like what you're doing for all these different causes. And
well, I appreciate you giving me a platform. I think the work you do is important as well, because you are targeting a market in its in yourself, you know, in the podcast that you do. So thank you for giving me this platform and allowing me to spread some lovely little tips and talks.
No, yeah, everything you said is super valuable, and I'm sure people will have like a lot to take away from this conversation. I mean, like your advice. So yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to rate and review the show, because that makes a huge difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out.
If you've gained anything from listening to this podcast, please do consider supporting the show through a one-off coffee donation or even a monthly donation if you can. This would help compensate speakers for their valuable time and contribute greatly to continuing the show.
Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you again soon.